Right, so G minus two then, after a whole week on topics. I've narrowed the title down a bit, obviously, so I have a fair amount of overview material at the beginning, but nevertheless, I would like to take the opportunity to update you on where we stand in our efforts to try to get towards a phenomenological, data-driven analysis of the light-by-light scattering. All right, so the motivation is pretty clear. We want to look at the anomalous magnetic moments as precision observables in the hope that in comparing their experimental determination with what the standard model tells us, we might uncover deviations that serve as hints for new physics. Yes.
Maybe could you move it up here, sure.
Oh, that's the microphone
recording.
It's not recording. You have to speak up. That is.
If you're
you go on this side.
If you're having trouble hearing, then I just need to speak up.
Yeah. Or you go on this side then.
Well, then I need to first.
Susan can go on that side.
Okay, problem solved. So the reason why you're particularly interested in the muon is that there are competing effects. Of course, you know, the electron experimentally at the highest precision, but the sensitivity to new physics will be largest with scale with the square of the lepton mass, so it will be largest for the tau, which unfortunately we can't really measure that well, and there are only very rough limits at this point, so the sweet spot is sort of the muon. Which can both be measured and predicted within the standard model at very high precision. And of course, what makes this even more interesting at this point is that there's a long-standing discrepancy of around 3 sigma or so, which may or may not hint that there's new physics hiding in the muon G minus 2. Now, in addition, there is a new round of experiments coming up. So there's one fairly advanced at Fermilab that aims at cutting the uncertainty by a factor of 4. I'm supposed to start data taking next year. And the pointer. The uncertainty that they anticipate having in the end is about 15 units of 10 to the minus 11. And for all the additional quantities that are going to be discussed in the course of this talk, this is going to be our reference point. So we want to do at least as good as that. Then, in addition to the Fermilab efforts, there's R&D going on at JPARC in a very interesting approach to not measure G minus 2 in a huge salt ring, but in a much more low-energy experiment. The challenge, of course, being that the muons decay faster, so you need lots of statistics. Well, it's an ongoing struggle to see if they can get it to work. But if that would, of course, be extremely interesting, because it would be a completely independent experimental technique and could therefore check the Brookhaven or the new Fermilab number completely independently. The comparison of these, for comparison of these two methods, I would point to this nice review by Gorenc and Herzog about precision muon physics, where really the virtues of the two methods are compared in detail. However, for this talk, we're going to now concentrate on theory and see what we need to do in order to match any experimental developments. So, for that, let's go through the individual pieces of the standard model prediction. As usual, it all starts with scalar QED at one loop level, that is with QED, and already there was already a spoiler for the hadronic part of the talk. So, at one loop level, we have the Schwinger term, then at two loops, there are, in addition to photon loops, internal lepton loop corrections. And then there are many more diagrams worked out up to fifth order by Kinoshita and collaborators. So that this is now really known to very high precision. There are couple of remarks here. So what I did to get numbers out of this is you have to put in some value for the fine structure constant, and this is taken here from the electron g-2. That is not really anymore what one would do these days, because even in the electron g-2, one is reaching a position where conceivably new physics contributions could be tested. So one would rather prefer to take the fine structure constant from some atomic measurement push this to further accuracy, and then also try and use the electron g-2 to try and find deviations. However, at this point, the accuracy is in the atomic measurements is maybe a factor of 10 or so away, and the determinations of alpha from the electron g-2 and the atomic measurements agree within one sigma or so, so it won't have any impact on these numbers. A second comment is that if we compare to our aim of 15, then you see that the fifth order contribution is already a factor of 3 down or so. But of course, the fourth order one is extremely important, and one might ask, what about checks of these calculations? There is no completely independent evaluation of the fourth and fifth order contributions. However, there are many independent checks of the fourth order one by completely independent techniques. So not based on just calculating the loop intervals in a relatively straightforward fashion, just by doing all the integrals numerically, but by using asymptotic expansions and trying to compare different classes of diagrams. Yes, Dean.
So Martin, your comment about getting the fine structure constant from atomic measurements rather than the electron g-2, is it the fear that you might have the same new physics that cancels out so you don't see it? Is that the point you're making?
Because I know that what could happen is that there's a new physics contribution in the electron g-2.
Yeah.
You can't exclude that.
Yeah, but there could be new physics in the atomic precision.
Yes, that could happen. People have looked at this, but then it would be a different process, right?
Yes, yeah, so basically the argument it would be different new physics.
Yes.
Are there contributions which would not scale with some of the mass of the electron?
People have found those contributions. Yes, there are examples for that. All right, so then once we're done with the QED part, there are electroweak contributions. Those are, after the Higgs discovery, now complete up to 2-loop level, and there are estimates of the leading log contributions at 3 loops. The remaining uncertainty is actually dominated by hadronic effects in the electroweak contributions, so by light quarks running around one of these triangle diagrams here. But of course, all the troubles start once we get to the hadronic contributions. That's the leading order one. Then at subleading orders, there's an iteration of that, as well as a new topology, the light-by-light one, which will be the main focus of my talk. Then people have also looked at this at even higher orders in the QED expansion. So at next to leading order, there was a surprisingly large iteration of hadronic vacuum polarization, which to a large extent could be traced back to diagrams like this, where you have light by light contribution with an electron loop and then an hadronic vacuum polarization in one of the photon legs. That is really quite large. So if you compare the convergence from leading order to next leading order, you get about what factor of 70 or so, and if that would hold true also going from next leading order to next leading order, you would expect the value at least a factor of 5 or so smaller than that. So this motivated us to also look at the next leading order light by light one, so the opposite topology, where you attach an additional electron polarization to one of the photon legs. But that scales more or less as you would expect. So that is really small and so well within our uncertainty budget. Yes.
What do the numbers for delta A mu mean for the lower QEDs?
You mean the meaning of the errors for the QED calculation?
Yeah.
Oh, correct. So at leading order, that is just alpha. So the uncertainty you propagate from the electron fine structure constant. At So up to and including third order, all is known analytically. So there are no numerical effects. However, at second and third order, in addition to the uncertainty in alpha, you get in principle uncertainties from the masses. So, and it just so happens that at second order there's a small remaining contribution, whereas at third order, at this level of accuracy, there's nothing left. And then at fourth and fifth order, the uncertainties refer essentially to Monte Carlo errors from your Lubin-Ewalds. All right, so taking everything together, we get presently an uncertainty in theory of pretty much the same level as this experiment, where we should note that for the error in the hadronic light-by-light case, it took more or less the most pessimistic scenario on the market. And in doing so, taking everything together, you end up at a discrepancy about 3 sigma with an uncertainty on the theory side almost exclusively from the hadronic part. Right. Any questions at this point?
I wanted to ask about the relative error assessments in the hadronic vacuum polarization, comparing leading order and extending order to transfer and LO. I guess simply I'm going to think that naively they should be suppressed by alpha as I go down. And so I'm just trying to understand whether or not this assessment that if you say that n squared LO is a factor of 10, let's say the error scales down by 10, even though you've added essentially a factor of alpha, then is it reasonable to think that from going from leading order to next leading order that it can really be a factor of 40 smaller? I'm just looking at the numbers and wondering at the reasonability of the error assessment.
Yeah, but the errors scale roughly with essential values, don't they? So you go from leading to next leading order, you go down a factor of 70 in the essential value, and factor of 40 in the error.
Sorry, say it again, I did not hear you.
So you have a factor of 70 in the essential value and a factor of 40 in the error. Isn't that sort of reasonable? So what they're doing is...
I was just looking at the scaling, but...
Maybe I don't get your question, but...
I guess I was looking at the pattern of the error bar, and it's just a numerology, so maybe it's just dismissible out of hand. But I just was seeming to me that this, given that you're saying that, maybe it's okay. Because basically your ability to assess N squared LO as a relative fraction is about the same as N squared LO.
The enhancement that you see in the central value roughly translates into the enhancement in the error.
Why is the error in this n squared also small? Well, is there not the light by light at least implicitly involved?
So here, that's just the factor of 10 that you get from going from here to here.
Yeah, but I mean, the diagram looked like light by light, right? I mean, or some
But electron light by light. So then, the only error you get is whatever you propagate from your electron
positions. Okay, fine. In the leading order, does this include tau decay data or only plus and minus?
That is only plus and minus, but I'll briefly comment on this point in a second. All right, so let's come to the outline for the rest of the talk. As a starter, I exactly the first comment on the status in hadronic vacuum polarization, and then describe what we suggest to do for light by light, and then discuss many details of this, and let's see how far we get. So the general, and I should also disclaimer right at the beginning, I will not talk about lattice at all. So any of the recent developments, I will not be discussing this talk, although there would be a lot to talk about. But for that, that would be a separate seminar, I think. So, on the phrenology side, what one does for hadronic vacuum polarization is that you essentially look at general principles of your amplitude. So, first of all, you use gauge invariance in order to write the polarization tensor just in terms of one scalar function. Then one uses analyticity in order to rewrite it in terms of its imaginary part. That's the second step. Then step three is you relate this imaginary part in terms of a cross-section, E plus and minus to hadrons, that you can then go ahead and measure an experiment. Now, that is really the best case scenario that there could possibly be. So in the case of the dispersion relation, you even get one subtraction for free because you only need the normalized self energy. And for the rest, it's one lone structure, it's one kinematic variable, and you have no free parameters. And then, in principle, it's straightforward, and there's a dedicated plus and minus program underway in order to improve the cross-section measurements. But of course, in practice, it's really hard to get systematics to below 1% or so. And that is precisely the challenge as far as hadronic vacuum position is concerned. So the accuracy that is being quoted at the moment is already below 1%, 0.6% or so. And in order to match the accuracy of the next round of G-2 experiments, you would need to push this to 0.2% or so. And then we're entering exactly the systematic. So there was this long-standing debate about tau data, where there seemed to be disagreements concerning Eisenman violating corrections and so on. But I think this is now more or less settled, and there are these raw photon mixing effects that Fritiga and Lena discussed. And once these are included, the big picture seems more consistent, but then the conclusion also appeared to be that you don't gain that much by including the tau data. So you get only a part of the response that you actually need for G-2, and it appears that once you add all the additional corrections, including their uncertainties, it's not that big a gain anymore, but in principle it could be done.
So does one understand the discrepancy between Chloe and Baba here?
Yeah, getting there. Okay. So the second point is systematics in the Pi-Pi channel. So there's, before the best three measurement arrived, there were essentially two competing high precision measurements, one from Chloe and from Baba, and you see that the central values don't really agree. There are also older measurements from Novosibirsk, which also more or less agree with the Chloe and now the best three data. So if you just look at this picture, then one might conceivably say that there could be an issue with the initial state radiation data at Baba. Now, what exactly that is, I could only speculate, and I'm not going to do that. But it seems at this point that the number that you get from the Baba data is a bit of an outlier. So I'm not sure what can be done about this. Apparently,
so Baba is the only one which uses initial state, but
as far as I know, there is no number from Bella. Okay. And all the rest are really plus-minus measurements. And there's more evidence in this direction. So from these Pi-Pi data, the 3-2 contributions are not the only thing that you can extract, because in the plus and minus measurements, you also have a contribution from our omega mixing that you see as a distortion in the vector form factor. And from that, you can actually extract the omega to 2 pi width. And doing that, you see a similar picture, that the numbers that you get from the plus and minus measurements are roughly consistent, whereas the number that you extract from the Baba form factor is a bit of an outlier.
How do you get the yellow band? What's the example?
The yellow band is just the best three data. So that is
excluding the Baba data?
No, that is from their paper. That is from the best three paper, and they just indicated their range to show where their competitors lie. That does not imply any sort of average data. So that is. Yeah, so the message here is that the biggest challenge in getting this under to the 0.2% accuracy or so is understanding the remaining systematic effects that appear at that level of precision. Okay, so let's move on to light by light. The challenge here historically has been that this has often been estimated just by hadronic modeling. So there was no direct relation to experimental data as for the hadronic vacuum polarization case. And the question was whether that was really an irreducible uncertainty that one could not systematically improve on. If you look at, so that is a table from review from 7 years ago, from different groups, different models, and different contributions. And one of the main issues here seemed to be that the different classes that have been mentioned, so pion pole, pion loops, axial scalars, and so on, were not necessarily the same in the different calculations, because it's all hadronic models, and there was no unambiguous definition for the individual quantities. So that is already the first aim that that we tried to address when we started this project, and provide unambiguous definitions for all the different classes. And the second motivation was to copy the strategy that is being used in hadronic vacuum polarization as closely as possible, namely to try and stay as data driven as possible and see how far these constraints from analyticity, unitarity, and crossing can actually get you. Now, the situation is obviously much more complicated because now you have a four-point function instead of a two-point function. You have 5 kinematic variables instead of just 1, and many more Lorentz structures, although I will show in a minute that in the end one only has 7 really independent master structures. So what we try to do is to circumvent this Folk theorem that the light-by-light contribution cannot be expressed in terms of measurable quantities.
Actually, yes. isn't rather a theorem by particular Folk? I thought there was a paper by Rams and Ruzov and Marfar saying that there was a low energy constant associated with this particular contribution that couldn't be fixed anywhere else.
There are KPT calculations for G minus 2, yes. But then the question exactly arises. You can predict the non-analytic pieces, but you don't know the low energy constant, which you could fix.
I thought that was the content, that you would end up measuring it by measuring G minus 2 or something. Sort of it's circular. I mean.
Yeah, but I'm not sure their message was stop measuring G minus 2.
Pardon?
I don't think their message was stop measuring G minus 2.
I thought the comment was reason that there was this book there was that if you were interested in G minus 2, then you would end up with a lower energy constant, so you would be more predictive.
Yeah, but that was not only based on their statements, so there are more of these in the literature.
I'm sorry, still not hearing you. Could you either say the words distinctly or a bit louder? I don't know why I find this so challenging, but what did you say?
So the paper by Ramzi Muzov and Wise was not the only one making statements in this direction.
Fine, but how do we do that now? I mean
that is what I'm trying to convince you of.
That
is a point of view that is no longer tenable.
Okay, good. So let's see and hope that you'll say it more loudly.
All right, so let's proceed. There's actually a number of model approaches on the market, and many of them are more than just near models, so there are always some aspects of QCD, some rigorous constraints of QCD that are incorporated. So for example, there are some short distance constraints, there are the Kao perturbation theory calculations that Susan just alluded to. There are some rules for gamma star to X, and then there are also constraints from low energies by matching to parameter probabilities, for example. All right, so what we are trying to do relies on dispersion theory, precisely as the example for hadronic vacuum polarization that I started with. So if you don't know how this works, this is probably not going to help you, but nevertheless, let me show one slight introduction to dispersion relations. So you start off from Cauchy's theorem in this form, where let's assume we have a function that has a left and right hand cut on the real axis, but is analytic otherwise. Then you can deform the contour in your Cauchy integral in this form so that it evolves around the cuts and possible poles on the real axis. Then let's assume that the function falls off sufficiently fast that you can ignore the circle at infinity. So in this way, you get a function like this, where the function is determined in terms of its pole contributions and the discontinuity along the cut. However, in practice, of course, it's often not really justified to ignore the contour at infinity. So in such a case, you have to introduce subtractions, which essentially means, or which you can view as subtracting the same function at zero, and then you get one power more in the denominator to suppress the high energy contribution, but you get one free constant that you don't really know and have to determine from somewhere. So of course, this only helps you if you know more about the imaginary part than you know about the real part. In practice, how this works is by using unitarity. So in the forward direction, that is just the optical theorem. And that is exactly what was used for Hadronic back compensation in order to get the imaginary part from the plus or minus to hadron's cross-section. Now, for partial waves, in a partial wave basis for scattering processes, there's a similar relation that just fixes the imaginary part of a given partial wave in terms of the modulus squared of the amplitude. And what's also worth stressing is that in this setup, once you have a pole contribution to your amplitudes, then the residue that determines the strength of this pole is really reaction independent and should be the same in any process where that resonance can contribute.
Are you sure that one subtraction is always sufficient?
No, of course not.
We'll come to that.
That was just an example, so there are, in specific cases, there are constraints on how fast the amplitude can behave. So for a general scattering process, you know that two subtractions are enough because of the Fossard bound. That certainly needs to be decided case by case. Also, it doesn't always help you to know that in principle, one or two subtractions are enough if you don't know your high energy input sufficiently accurately, that you're sensitive to energy regions, but you don't know, then you have to over subtract anyway. And if you use more parameters, then you would absolutely have to guarantee convergence. All right, so why are we doing this in the first place? The point here is that once you're formulating things in terms of the analytic structure, so poles and cuts of the amplitude, you've already gained a lot because these are quantities that are related to these residues and to imaginary parts that are actually measurable quantities. So those do not depend on your hadronic model, but those can be extracted from experiment, at least in principle. Now, for the specific case of the light-by-light contribution, there are a couple of challenges. So first of all, it's not that obvious anymore what is the best basis, tensor basis that one should use, and I'll spend a fair amount of time describing how we do this. And also, because of the large number of amplitudes, and there's no closed formula anymore, as you have for the recomposition case, where you can just write the whole thing as an integral, essentially, over the plus or minus to Hadron's cross-section. So for that reason, you need an additional organizing principle, and that organizing principle is going to be the mass of the intermediate states. So obviously, the most important ones then are going to be pseudoscattered poles, and next there will be two meson cut contributions. So that explains more or less roughly how the decomposition is going to be organized. All right, so let's start with this problem of how to find suitable basis. So first, I'm going to need a little bit of notation. So this is just the kinematics for the light-by-light tensor that I will use. Then the definition in terms of the time order product. And then you can start writing down the most general Lorentz decomposition of this. If you just count all different amplitudes in a naive counting, you would end up with 138 of those functions. But actually, 2 years ago, one group discovered that in four dimension, there's a weird ambiguity, which makes these three terms that depend on the metric tensor all equivalent. So this brings it down to just 136, which might not seem like such a big deal, but it actually is, as I'll comment on later. So then as a next step, we can't really use that basis because we want something that already includes or incorporates gauge invariance, just as in the hadronic back compensation case where that allowed us to reduce things to just one function. And finally, by imposing these gauge invariance constraints, we need to make sure that we do not introduce any kinematic singularities or zeros. Because that would imply that we can't do dispersion theory anymore for these scalar functions. So to understand how this works, let's make a small detour and consider the subprocess, so gamma star to pi pi. In that case, the element that we're considering takes this form, where Now the decomposition only involves 10 scalar functions if you just write down all Lorentz structures that are available. So one metric tensor, and then you have 3 independent vectors. Engagement variance tells you that that decomposition must fulfill those two conditions. And it's well known how to do this in a systematic fashion. So as shown many years ago by Bardeen and Tang, what you can do to get there most efficiently is just to define projectors. So that one, and then just hit your tensor with these two projectors in both variables. And by doing so, you essentially kill all the stuff that would not contribute, and only those independent gauge invariant structures will survive. So that is how you get down from 10 to just 5. However, the price you pay in this procedure is that in this step, you have introduced kinematic singularities. So in order to revert that step, essentially what you have to do is to go from the highest singularities step by step to the lowest one, and you move those from the tensors. And by doing so, you get to a different basis that is then independent of these nodes. So doing so, that is what you get for this case. But there's another twist in the story, namely that basis only works for kinematics where the scalar product Q1.Q2 does not vanish, as shown by Tao a couple of years later. And if you go to that limit, the basis actually becomes degenerate, and you need an additional structure in order to span the whole space. So in the end, if you want to have an admittedly redundant set of functions that describe the whole thing, you need to add this one additional Taro structure, and that is how you get to 5 plus 1 functions. So there's a final footnote for the gamma star, gamma star to pi, pi case, namely you have an additional symmetry, crossing symmetry in the pions, and by exploiting this, you can actually get rid of one of these functions, but that's not going to be relevant for the rest. So let's return to light by light. In this case, a basis, once you apply these projectors, you get down from the 138 structures just to 43 that survive. But in order to remove these degeneracies in certain kinematic corners, you again need to introduce additional functions, and in this case, there are 11 more. So in the end, you get 54 functions, but only 7 of those are really independent. All the other ones you can get from crossing symmetry. The reason I mentioned this redundancy in four space time dimensions is that if you look at the basis, and you make use of the fact that you have these two additional ambiguities, that would take you down from 43 to 41. And that is an important reduction, because 41 is precisely the number of independent helicity amplitudes that are there for fully offshore light-by-light scattering. And this has to be the case. So the number of independent amplitudes has to match on both levels, the independent number of helicity amplitudes and Lorentz structures. So that is very important theoretically, but for the setup of the calculation, we're still going to work with these 54 functions. And the 7 generating ones are actually relatively small, and that is the list that you can get, and all the rest follows from that. So in the end, we only need a dynamical calculation of these 7 scalar functions, which is already pretty nice simplification, given the complications of the whole process that one started with. All right, so once you've established this decomposition of the tensor, you can then go ahead and calculate what is actually the form or the contribution to G minus 2 from the individual scalar functions that you get there. That is precisely what's done here. So you get the two-loop integral or the propagators, and then just a linear combination of these scalar functions that I've defined previously and some known kernel functions that can be calculated. In fact, one can even go one step further and perform 5 of these integrals, rotate to a space like kinematics, and in this way get just a 3 integral representation of the light-by-light contribution in terms of these scalar functions that we aim to calculate. At this point, I should mention that there is a competing effort on the market where you don't do dispersion theory for the light-by-light tensor, but directly for the form factor. So you would consider the Pauli form factor and all possible cuts therein, and in the end, then recover a mu by going to zero in the momentum transfer of the form factor. Now, the concern that we would voice in this context is that it's not clear that that is a very efficient approach for the following reason. So in doing so, you essentially also do the two-loop integral that is done here with standard methods by doing dispersion theory. So you already waste a lot of effort into redoing a two-loop integral that you already know how to do by another technique. In principle, you would have to do this in addition to any complications that I'm showing here. So whatever is going to come in the rest of the talk, you would then have to fold this in with additional bunch of cuts that you get from the loop integrals. All right, so in setting up the calculation then, the first contribution would come from the zero scalar Pauli exchange. We've done the projection onto this BTT basis, and what is nice there is that what appears in the master formula essentially produces explicit expressions that were already available in the literature. The main thing that needs to be done here is to incorporate these gains from the asymptotic behavior on this contribution and determine the transition form factor that describes these vertices. And I'll comment a bit more later on how this can be done in practice.
Are the external legs on show?
One is.
Just one? So you only have seven form factors, including the dependence, or seven functions, including the dependence on those masses.
These seven functions all depend on all possible kinematic variables, so and on the Mannfrom variables and the virtualities. That is why I said you have five scalar invariants.
Which are the Mannfrom variables plus the Qs.
Yes. So STU, Q1, Q2, Q3, and then not all of them anyway. All right, so the second contribution,
I just wanted to ask about the dot, dot, dot in the manifest expression. Could I not have an A1, A1 full contribution?
Yes, of course.
So that's embedded in the dot, dot, dot.
Another disclaimer, all I'm going to say is geared towards pi and intermediate states. So eta, eta prime are a trivial copy of the pi zero, and kk bar will be a trivial copy of pi-pi intermediate states.
Oh, so these are extensions that you think are not technically more complicated.
Right, so then the major complications for the eta eta prime or for kk bar intermediate states concern the input that you would need in order to determine form factors and amplitudes, but there's nothing conceptually new. Whereas there are further higher intermediate states like 3-pi, where you would have to think again.
So the concrete statement is that however I articulate this ultimate tensor that would influence the final projection on the BTT basis, namely what the coefficients precisely are, but not the fact that you have seven independent scalar functions finally.
That is completely independent of whatever intermediate sets you look at. The lower state composition that I just presented is regardless.
The ultimate result of the projection. Does not matter? Okay.
I'm not sure I'm getting your question.
I'm just arguing any truncation of the original tensor, if presumably its precise content has relevant to precise coefficients in the final projection to the other basis. or maybe do that issue.
And the results, of course, will be affected by high intermediate states, but
nevertheless,
not the general form.
Pardon?
Not the general form.
Okay, right.
When you look at the one pion propagator, do you consider in the same context already the continuum that starts from three pions, or is that done separately?
That's a good question. So that relates to the question how you incorporate constraints from photography QCD, because there are relations that concern the axial channel, and in fact you could use the 3-pi channel in order to properly incorporate some of them. That is not what is meant here. So what is meant here is really just the contribution of the pion pole, nothing else. But that is a point that has caused some discussion in the past.
and not that far away. Though.
Right, and indeed the 3-pi intermediate states, in particular where you can excite some axial resonances or so, are likely to be the leading contribution in the dot, dot, dot chart. All right, so next, there are 2-pi intermediate states. And when we started with this analysis, we made the following observation. So suppose you consider a scalar QED calculation and consider the box diagram in that calculation. Then that has simultaneous cuts in two channels. So suppose now that you take the primary cut in the pi-pi system, because that is how we defined our contribution. Then what you could do in the next step is you also take the cut in the cross channel. So in the left-hand cut, you also separate just the pion pole. Now, in scalar QED, what happens is that the pion box itself is not gauge invariant. So you need to add these triangle and bulb diagrams in order to get the gauge invariant contribution. But just by looking at the box diagram and putting the intermediate pieces on shell, in the end, what you end up with is sub-amplitudes where you have on-shell pions. And in that case, the pion vector form factor gives you the exact dependence on the virtualities. So for that reason, we conjectured that if you do that in this way and just calculate scalar QED by multiplying with the corresponding form factors, you actually get the same contribution that you would obtain if you take the 2-pi intermediate states and the left-hand cut from pion poles. So that is what we showed in the second paper. So now with the BTT basis, we could do this explicitly and construct a representation for these pi-pi intermediate states with the pion pole left-hand cut. Then we could check explicitly that that agrees just with what we call form factor scalar QED calculation. So that is already a first very important result, namely it provides a unique definition of what people before have called a pion loop. So if you do this, calculate in scalar QED and multiply with the form factors, we can uniquely translate this into what is meant in terms of its analytic structure.
Aren't there all kinds of, with virtual external legs, aren't there all kinds of anomalous singularities and stuff? The Mandelson representation assumes everything's on shell.
Not for space like kinematics. Hmm? Not for space like kinematics. All the anomalous thresholds play a role if you want to construct a box diagram dispersively time-like kinematics. So we have thought about this issue of anomalous thresholds extensively. Indeed, we've constructed a dispersive representation for the triangle diagrams and for general kinematics. And then indeed you see how these anomalous thresholds appear, but they all go away once you rotate to space-like kinematics.
Once you
rotate to space-like kinematics. Okay, so then the first correction to this form factor scalar QED contribution is what I call this name here. And the basic physics that goes in there is a pi-pi rescattering effect. So any contribution to the left-hand cut that goes beyond just the pion pole. And the plan here is to do this within a partial wave expansion. Oh yeah, as I said before, a similar program holds for eta, eta prime poles, and also KK bound intermediate states by simply copying what we presented so far. So to go into a bit more detail of the individual pieces for the pi on the pole, the expressions are actually pretty simple. So the main challenge here is to determine the corresponding transition form factors. So you need to know what the coupling strength at these form factors is for the on-shell meson, and then you need to determine the dependence on the virtualities. And so in the end, if I have time, I'll say a bit more about what the pi zero. If you want to know more about eta eta prime, then Andreas would be the person to talk to. So next, the pi on box. Again, after having shown that you can just do the calculation scalar QED, you can use this to derive some compact expressions for that. And indeed, that works amazingly well. So in general, the computation is fairly complicated, but once expressed in this BTT basis, it becomes extremely compact. So that is what you see here, and that is not cheating. Also, all the other functions that you need are of similar complexity. In particular, what one can see in this representation is that it's manifestly free of all kinematic singularities. You only need a couple of these functions, with all the rest being reconstructed from crossing symmetry. So that is an example. So after having taken the fourth photon on shell, it's not only seven functions, but in principle 9 independent ones. So these are a couple of examples of crossing relations that there are. However, if you write things in terms of these pi I bar that in the end are relevant for the master formula, you're even down to just 6 independent ones. So based on this, we can produce some first numerics. The only input needed for this pion box is the pion vector form factor. So the first thing that you can do is you can just take a VMD model for that, you can also use phenomenological input. And here's one version of that. And what we discovered, a bit to our dismay, is that VMD actually works surprisingly well. So that is the number that you get. And you can already compare this to what you would get for the kaon loop. And it's already suppressed much below that. So again, recall that in the end, 15 in these units is the threshold from experiment. So this kaon box contribution is already way below that. That is the comparison to the table that I showed in the beginning. So the line that you need to look at here is pion and kaon loops. If you look at some of the entries, then our number is not so far away from the central value, so the minus 19 that is being coded repeatedly. However, one should also look at the errors. And in particular, given that it was not clear what is precisely meant by these contributions in a given model. So in this context, one should say that the outcome of this is not necessarily to find the big shift in the central values, but first to clarify what's meant, and second to reduce the uncertainty.
Can you remind us the acronyms, the abbreviations, what the different methods were, why they
different hadronic models. So they're BPP. They're essentially doing an NJL model. So starting from here, that is essentially compilations of the other ones. That is what the central values agree. The pion here is another variant of scalar QED putting in form factors by some variation. Melnikov-Weinstein is an argument based on large NC, so that is why they didn't even bother to calculate the pion loop, but just gave an estimate. Yeah, I think that's all I have to say on this at this point.
Sorry, why do you only need this space-like pion form factor in the box?
That was this step. So you start from the two-loop integrals, this form, and then you rotate to space like kinematics.
Okay.
So that was this step about weak rotations.
Okay.
So actually, this has always been assumed in the literature that you can just do this. And one exercise that we did in our last paper is to check that it actually can be done. So I think I have a...
The answer is yes.
The answer is yes. So I have a spare slide on this, or I don't know, you can just... So that is the trajectories that we looked at. So the... it's a complicated picture. So in the end, what could happen is that once you switch the sheets in the complex plane, it could happen that you hit the contour in such a way that you need to drag it downstairs and then produce these enormous pieces. But if you look at what trajectories you actually need in order to do this weak rotation, you can show that does not happen. Yeah, but we were...
That was just a 2m pi? The range?
So the unitarity cut starts at 4m squared.
Right.
And then you essentially... The contours that you would have to look at is in the virtualities in the different regions. So I'm not sure that picture helps too much without explaining it in much more detail, but that's just to demonstrate that we did look at that. Mike, we had a question.
The last table that you were showing, what does the entry for quark loops mean, distinct from all the Hadoop stuff?
Very good question. So it could well be that the main impact of doing this in dispersion theory is to get rid of the quark loop. You could think about some flavor separation, so there are no low-lying state that would have a charm quark in it. So if you wanted to estimate effects from charm and higher, then probably doing a quark loop would be a decent approximation. However, for anything else, it's not clear what happens, because here you always have this problem that you're doing some sort of constituent quark model, and then you don't really know what a clear separation of contributions is and how you would address possible double counting issues. So yeah, at the moment it's pretty clear that there will not be a quark loop in our final number, and all constraints that people try to incorporate by means of the quark loop will have to be reflected by constraints on perturbative QCD. So for the light by light tensor, you can derive constraints from perturbative QCD on the asymptotic behavior of the scalar functions that are showed. These have to be implemented, and what you just mentioned about the axial case, the interplay of 1 pi and 3 pi intermediate states is one example for that. This is most likely going to be a very important constraint, but a quark loop is certainly not the right way to get there.
In regards to heavy fibers, it would seem to be more natural to extend your analysis with KK bar exchange to dB bar, etc., in order to analyze all of those possibilities rather than
I'm not sure because then you would have all sorts of allowed intermediate states, and I don't see how you can resum all of them.
Oh.
So look, if you want to take a dD bar cut in the primary channel, but then in the crossed one, you would have all sorts of allowed light intermediate states.
Oh, so you're saying your method would not generalize them to heavy
fibers. Right. That wouldn't work. So I think if you want to trace some charm effects, then a charm loop is probably still your best guess. All right, then another interesting feature you could look at is convergence. So of course, the underlying assumption of this approach is that the main contributions are generated by low and intermediate energies. And for this one contribution, you can now check if that actually works. So if you impose just a cutoff on the energy integral, you see that if you stop at 1 GeV or 1.5 GeV, then for this pion box, you generate already 95-99% of the whole result. So for this particular contribution, this certainly works. Then, of course, the next really interesting contribution would be from rescattering effects. So for this, we finally need to write down the dispersion, the full dispersion relations for these scalar functions. There's one example shown here where one keeps one of the Mandelbrot variables fixed in such a way that that is consistent with G minus 2 kinematics. Then the imaginary parts that appear in these dispersion relations are related to these unitarity diagrams where the blobs are determined by gamma star to pi, pi amplitudes. All this needs to be projected on this BTD basis. You wrote this down for S waves 2 years ago, and now we finally have it for the general case. There were a couple of very interesting puzzles along the way. So there was this D equal to 4 ambiguity that I now mentioned repeatedly. The reason that is really interesting is that it proved to be really important to work with combinations of amplitudes where that ambiguity drops out. Otherwise, the partial wave convergence was really bad. Then there is a certain number of freedom within the BTT approach right on dispersion relations because of different mass dimensions, the various amplitudes, and this implies a set of sum rules that ought to be fulfilled. And we checked indeed with scalar QD that they are fulfilled. So that was a big step. However, these sum rules are only valid for the full amplitude, so it's not guaranteed that they work to a decent level once you expand in terms of partial waves. So checking that that is indeed the case was another important step. And then finally, a big puzzle at intermediate times was that it seemed that unphysical photon polarizations could contribute. So if you start with the calculation for technical reasons, you would look at the fully off-shell process of 4 off-shell photons, and then in the end, reduce things to the case where one of them is on-shell. And the amplitudes for longitudinal polarization for one on-shell photon would not drop out. And that was indeed a puzzle. But finally, we understand how this happens and how one can construct manifestly a version of the formalism where all the unphysical polarizations drop out. And then finally, we look at the test case where you look at the partial wave expansion of this form factor scalar QD contribution, and that is what I would like to show next. So these are the results as a function of the angular momentum on in the left panel, the absolute contribution for fixed S, fixed T, or fixed U dispersion relation. You can see that the individual pieces nicely move to zero, and then on the right panel, what is shown what you get by summing up to a maximal J, and indeed they all converge to the expected number. In this case, these different dispersion relations are all equivalent because the contribution we're looking at is highly crossing symmetric. However, the fixed S case is a bit special, so there's no S channel cut and there are some cancellations. That is why look at the fixed S here, you only see a very small contribution at J equal to zero, but a relatively large one for D waves. The reason for that can really be understood that there are cancellations at the amplitude level, and that just happens. However, in addition, one can use these sum rules that I mentioned earlier in order to actually optimize that partial wave convergence, and that's what we're working on at the moment to try to see if one can do even a little bit better than that. What you can also do is, so if you look at the summation up to J equal 20 or so, you're very close to the final number, which is minus 16.42. And this, but for T and U, you see a little bit of deviation here, then you can just play games to extrapolate based on this formula that Martin kindly suggested to us. It works very nicely, and we again get essentially to the full result. Now, to go beyond this pi and box contribution, things become a bit more complicated because you have much less crossing symmetry. So in order to map out all the different cuts that are allowed to contribute, essentially what one has to do is a prescription in this form where you essentially average over the different versions and up to higher cuts, that is going to be the pi-pi rescattering contribution. So to get there, we need input for gamma star to pi pi. How do we do that? So for the on-shell case, gamma gamma to pi pi, there's nowadays a fair amount of data, and there even to the extent that you can do a partial wave analysis of this. However, it's completely implausible to get this for arbitrary virtualities. So there clearly has to be more data input, and one way is to take all the experimental constraints that there are and try to see how far we can get once combined with analyticity and unitarity techniques. So in the singly virtual case, this has already been done for the S-waves by Musalam. For the doubly virtual case, that is where we looked at these anomalous thresholds and convinced us that those only play a role in the time lag region. The constraints that there are at low energies are pi improbabilities, form factors, various scattering processes. I want to go into details here. So let's concentrate on the physics that one can try to capture with that. So essentially, the rescattering of the different partial waves can be considered a model-independent implementation of various resonance contributions. So for example, in D waves, in pi-pi scattering, you have this F2-1270, which is a very prominent resonance. And then in the S waves, you have the F0-500, which produces the main correction beyond just the pion power.
What exactly do you call the rescattering contribution?
Well, that is what I just defined. That is what I just defined.
Yeah.
So you take... So you take the two pion cut, you consider gamma star to pi pi in the subprocess, and then you subtract the pion pole pieces that is already in the pion box. All the rest is the rescattering. So, in particular, as concerns this F0-500 contribution, it's been well established that that can be very accurately be described in dispersion theory. So the first reliable extraction of pole parameters comes precisely from a related approach, which incidentally was the reason why the name changed from 600 to 500 in the PDG, and why now there's a much narrower region for pole parameters and widths.
Do you use the full spectral function in that channel?
Yes, that is the whole point.
Generated by the calculation? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, that is the whole point of this procedure, that you don't have to rely on approximations anymore, but you get a model independent description thereof. So, as far as numerics from this are concerned, let me first start with a list of caveats. A full analysis of this gamma star to pi pi input is, again, quite a project. So you need to carefully assess the impact of subtractions, of the asymptotic behavior, of general contributions to the left-hand cup that are allowed, and in particular for the S wave, you have a strong coupling to the KK bar system that at some point you can't ignore. So to get a first estimate of how large these effects are, what I'm going to present here is a version where we again only take a left-hand pole that is then being unitarized, and also we take a phase shift from the so-called inverse amplitude method, which has the advantage that you essentially get rid of all the kaons. So you define in a well-defined way a phase shift, a pi pi S wave phase shift that only includes pions but no coupling to the KK bar states. So in addition, we've checked that this reproduces very nicely the F0-500 properties on low energy phase shifts, and provides us with some reasonable extrapolation to infinity. And finally, what's also nice is that in this way, because the rescattering is still determined by a pion pole, unitarized then, of course, but this implies that still the dependence on the off-shell behavior is still given determined by the pion form factor. So that we then use in order to solve the dispersion conditions for gamma star to pi pi. And these are the results. So the two lines are isospin 0 and isospin 2. And the different results are for different cutoffs in the in the dispersive energy interval. So we can see that there is some variation, some sensitivity to the cutoff. So in the end, looking more rigorously at which constraints you can get from perturbative QCD, say, is going to be very important. However, one sees that, in particular, the isospin zero part is already quite stable. So the preliminary conclusion that can be drawn from this is that this calculation indicates a contribution from the F0500 around minus 9 or so in our 10 to the minus 11 units. So in addition, I mentioned these sum rules in the beginning or in a couple of slides ago. There's one of them that actually involves S waves. So we can now check to what extent these are fulfilled. And based on the calculation that analyzed these numbers, that is already the case at about a 10% level or so, which is very good because the sum rules, again, should only be fulfilled once you sum over everything and a 90% saturation or more than 90% saturation just from S waves is already pretty much what we would expect. So then you can again compare this to the numbers in our table. And there are, so annoyingly, the number for the scalars that is being quoted is again not that far away from what we have here. But again, the main impact is going to be about uncertainties, because now we have really rigorously defined what we mean, and there's no possible ambiguity about this. All right. When should I stop? Harry?
I have
a bit more material about the pion pole, so maybe we can go quickly through this. So if you look at this table, then you will have noticed that actually by far the biggest contribution comes from pion and eta prime poles, and I haven't talked about this at all. So the reason for that is that, in fact, as far as the formalism is concerned, these are not that hard. So just projecting this onto the BTT basis is relatively straightforward, and then all you need to know, in quotation marks, is to determine this pion transition form factor, which again, for two offshore photons, is not that easy. So in principle, it can be measured, and in contrast to the gamma star to pi case, there are actually good prospects that there will be definitely singly virtual data and some doubly virtual data. But absent those results, what you can again do is to combine all phenomenologic information that you have on pion-photon interactions and try to combine those. So we have done this for the singly virtual form factor. So one intermediate step here is fixing parameters in e plus e minus to 3 pi, using this to predict the single virtual form factor and then predicting it in e plus e minus to pi 0 gamma. And what you see here is the comparison of this band to data. That this indeed works reasonably well. Then you can use another dispersion relation to go back to the space-like kinematics, and the prediction of this is shown here to a relatively old data. And I've shown this slide now for a while, and there's always soon to be tested at best 3. So at this point, I really hope that soon is going to be really soon and should be out in the very near future. And then one can prove, or can actually first of all check consistency, and in the second step, potentially improve the determination of the form factor by combining all experimental data. As I mentioned, a similar program exists for eta prime, which due to different quantum numbers, the challenges are a bit different, but there's also good progress on this. Then, yeah, I'm going to skip this. So if you take this all together, then we end up with two central pieces that we need. So this pion transition form factor on eta prime for the zero scalar poles, and for the pi rescattering piece, the partial waves for gamma star to pi. And then there's all sorts of processes that are potentially helpful in constraining those by combining experiment and theory. As mentioned on the way, multi-pion channels are probably going to be the next important ones that appear in the dot, dot, dot of the decomposition. And also one important future piece of work constrains concerns constraints from perturbative QC. So with that, let me conclude. I've given you an update of where we stand in our dispersive approach to light by light. So there are now preliminary numbers for pi m boxes and pi rescattering. All the challenges in the formalism are now largely solved, I would claim. In particular, it was quite remarkable to see how well this partial wave expansion works for the pi m box. That was really a very important check to get this to work. Then the next steps in the program are, as I mentioned, refining the analysis for the rescattering, calculating the W virtual form factors, implementing whatever QCD, and of course, in the end, perform an error analysis to see if one can identify some input quantity that whose improvement would really impact the final light by light number. Thanks.
At the end of the day, how much difference from the vector meson dominance calculation?
All right, so first of all, you need to define what you mean by the vector meson dominance calculation.
Yes, it's true.
That is that is important because there are several contributions that you can never get in VMD. So all these rescattering pieces are completely absent. So, however, if you look at intermediate results, so the pion vector form factor is the best example.
Wait, the rescattering pieces pi pi to 2 gamma. Why do you say there's no vector meson?
Oh, it's not unitarized. You can never get this. It's not unitarized. You can never get this in VMD. So you're trying essentially to calculate the sigma pole in a VMD model that can never work.
You need the full spectral function.
You need the full spectral function, right. So VMD always works nicely if you do it in the original sense. So if you set the pi and vector form factor is the best example for that. In this case, you're very close phenomenologically. But those are limited cases. Contributions like the sigma you can never get in a VMD picture.
What about more than 1 and 2 pion continua? I mean, even more than 3 pions, say, coupled to the 1 pion. Does one have any idea how this extends as you go higher and higher in the cuts, multi-pion continua?
The comparison I showed you here for pi on k on boxes indicates that the mass suppression that we're assuming really works quite well. So in particular, here you would naively expect that it should go down like m pi squared over m k squared, but it's even a factor of 3 more than that. So that is really pretty small. I think the most important estimate for these higher pi on channels are going to come from the corresponding resonances. So you can look at which resonances you have in 3 pi and 4 pi channels, and then you can see what is known about their electromagnetic form factors and try to see how this translates to an estimate in light by light. This may well be one of the largest pieces of uncertainty. Yes.
If you compare to your table with those models, right, I mean, there's this quantum contribution. Would you expect this contribution to go away completely, or will this strength be distributed among the other pieces somehow?
So part of this might be distributed to the pion pole, because it's not clear what happens once you
include
the PQCD constraints. Yes. So that might also be a piece that is numerically important to look at, but there will not be a glass quark loop in the end.
Yeah. Cool. In the worst case, right, the best case scenario, this 21 would be gone, right? But,
So at the moment, it really seems that all the contributions you've looked at so far, we haven't found anything that was outrageously different. So at this point, I would expect that the final number will end up somewhere in the ballpark of this, but with a much better defined uncertainty estimate.
I have a question in regards to the, let's say, the pool contributions. In particular, obviously the reliability to assess the transition form factors. And there's historic discrepancies in literature. For example, if we want to study beta to 2 gamma, compare analyses from rate of return versus, or analyses from Chloe versus Primakov process, experiments, I guess, at Shello, long time ago, they're several percent different. So what I guess wondering is whether, given the genetic data driven approach, there will be, I guess, ultimately, I suppose, systematic errors associated with disagreeing experiments, and we can only hope that the eta piece of this would be smaller than the pion piece.
Oh, it is by a lot. And Andreas, okay. do you want to comment on this eta to gamma?
Gamma has the advantage that you could look at the passing minus eta at.
And I'm remarking that there are two different measurements, one from Chloe, this and the E plus E minus collider, and the other one is from old Primakov data. And so I believe they want to repeat it at GLAB in some extension.
Yeah, but you want to double out a little offshoot form factor.
No, but I think you're asking about just the normalization, right? The normalization at zero.
Well, yes,
at
zero. Because the two experiments don't agree.
Yeah, sure.
And therefore, it seems to me speaks to a larger problem.
For the pi zero, the situation is very good. So the measurements that you have beautifully confirm the prediction from the Carroll anomaly. I don't know by heart what the situation is with the eta. Is there still a sizable discrepancy for the normalization of the form factors?
I saw a talk by Adrian Gall maybe a year ago, and I thought that was stunning. I mean, I think they have their own analysis their own number that should come out of their analysis. But it just, I just was curious, I mean, because of this broader issue, I mean, obviously the data-driven analysis is going to be beholden to the validity of
the data. Sure, so of course, whatever systematic uncertainty you have in the eta prime form factor normalization is going to translate to the.
But you know, at least the eta double offshore form factor might be easier because you can look at e passing minus eta, pi plus pi minus, and use that to get to make a dispersion analysis for pi plus pi minus with enough couple very strongly to eta. To get double offshore form. Simpler than for pion, because there you have all three pions to disentangle.
So I guess I have a separate question, just in regards to the discussion of perturbed PCP constraints. Your view is that you'll finish your analysis, put in all the pieces, and then try to see whether, they're not constrained per se, but we want to see whether your final results are consistent with suggestions in literature, or I'm just trying to understand what your perspective is on these things, whether they're cross-checked with constraints.
Both. Okay. So there's that is work in progress. There's several aspects to that. So you can look at individual contributions, the pion pole and correlations to 3 pi. There are constraints on this worked out in the literature. That is what Arkady Weinstein pointed out last fall. But also if you look at the construction of the gamma-gamma to pi-pi partial waves, then also you don't really know the high energy behavior. And already there, it would be useful to constrain this by independent QCD analyses. So there, for example, in this case, there are papers by Brodsky-Lepage on this that have certain implications for the high energy behavior of these partial waves that one could use. So yes, those would definitely all be used as constraints on the analysis, because it often happens if you write down dispersion relation that is geared towards low energy applications. Already by definition, essentially, because your you only take into account a certain set of intermediate states and ignore the rest and try to correct for this by introducing sufficient number of subtractions so that you're most sensitive to the low energy region. The consequence of that is that often dispersion relations have a bad high energy behavior. Again, largely by construction, and then trying to properly constrain this by additional input would be the obvious thing to do.
But nevertheless, anticipated high energy behavior is built into the level of subtraction should happen. So somehow we're already cognizant of what high energy behavior must look like.
And there's no one else, let's thank Martin again.